This is a Dreamcast disc and is for use only on a Dreamcast unit. Playing this disc on a hi-fi or other audio equipment can cause serious damage to its speakers.
Dreamcast, up to 6 billion players.
Welcome back to the stage of history.
Why don't we play together?
Hey, it's time to make some crazy money. Are you ready? Here we go!
Please stop this disc now.
Hello and welcome to another episode of DreamPod, the podcast by Dreamcast Junkyard. I'm Andrew, and today I am joined by one, two, three people. Hello, three people. The first of which is Mike. Hi, Mike. How are you?
Hello, Andrew. Yes, I am the first person, and I am well. Thank you.
Good. Second person is Lewis. How's it going, Lewis?
I'm not so bad. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thank you. I don't know how to respond to that. You're welcome. And last but not least, the third person out of four of us is Rob. Back again. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, Andrew. Thank you very much. And thanks for letting me come back on again.
Awesome to have you on. Like we said in the Dreamcast mini episode, happy to have you on whenever, really. So thanks for coming back. And yeah, we have another themed episode for you this time. And we're going to discuss, as you've probably seen, if you've kind of looked at the name of the podcast before you've listened to it, as most people tend to do, you will know that we're doing a Left in Japan special, all about the games that came out in Japan but never made it over here, and the ones that we'd really like to see. Hopefully at some point make it over, if we could wave a magic wand, I suppose. But before that, I'm going to go with tradition for a change, which is not like me. And I'm going to go around and ask what people are playing at the moment and if they've had any recent Dreamcast pickups. So I'm going to start with Lewis. Lewis, have you got anything to tell us?
I do not have any recent Dreamcast pickups, although... Maybe just to fill in here, I can remember there was one I didn't mention on the last podcast where we talked about pickups, and that was actually that I picked up Watts Shenmue. So I picked that one up, which is something I've always been intrigued to play, what with the, I suppose, lore on the internet about this like weird demo, you know, sort of a strange demo that really you probably wouldn't see again. You know, it was so unique, at which I suppose... You know, sums up Shenmue in a nutshell, really. I'm going to get a guide and I'm going to play it, and it's going to be really fun. And I'll look forward to the weird ending involving the head of Sega at the time with all the Dreamcasts that he can't sell. Yeah, it's going to be a good one.
That was quite, that's quite funny. Have you been playing anything besides not playing Watts Shenmue yet?
I've been sort of stuck in this like backlog that I'm just trying to clear out. So, I've nearly finished Persona 5 Royal, which is amazing. You know, play it if you haven't played Persona 5. But I did pick up a few new games, you know, ready for when, you know, I finished that. I got 13 Sentinels, Aegis Rim, which is this weird vanillaware tactical RPG story-based game. I kind of don't really know what it is, and I don't think anyone knows really how to describe it, because it seems like a very specific game. I remember actually seeing an advertisement for it on Twitter from Sega, and they basically the advertisement was based around, this is what this game is. You know, we're trying to explain it to, I think it must be like a really Japanese concept, but it seems to be some kind of mech tactical game with a lot of, you know, really good story elements. And because it's vanillaware, if anyone has played Dragon's Crown or Odin's Sphere, they're known for having really beautiful, like, sprite work or artwork. So it's got all of that in it. It looks great. Mm-hmm. And then the other one I bought, one I've always wanted to get but never got, and that's... Tales of Berseria. Everyone says that this game is really good, but I've never played it, and so I'm gonna give it a try. Yep.
Awesome. Sounds good. Cool. Mike, what about you? Have you do you have anything left to pick up for the Dreamcast at this point?
What? Yeah, yes, lots of stuff to pick up because okay. I'm strange and buy random things.
True.
Have I picked anything up? I think I've picked up since the last podcast. I don't think we did a round the table talk last time. So I picked up some more magazines. I've now got 190 Japanese Dreamcast magazines.
Wow.
And I've picked up a couple of random bits. I think the last PAL accessory I needed was a SCART cable in box. I picked that up. So nothing particularly amazing. Also, I've got the new indie games coming very soon. Mm-hmm. And I am currently playing through the third release candidate and pretty much the final version of Xenocider. Because I'm part of the pre-ordered it, so I've got the beta. But yeah, really, really good at that. But in terms of playing other things, so I've done a bit of rally gaming for the other podcast that me and Tom appear on. Mm-hmm. We've done some WRC9 came out a couple of days ago. For Power Drifting, our podcast, I've been playing that quite a bit. I've also been playing Tony Hawk's 1 and 2 Remastered, and I've also been playing Mafia Definitive Edition, which is fantastic. I've been playing that a lot this week.
Nice. That does look good. I kind of really want to get the Mafia Remastered Trilogy, because I always really like 2, and it looks like they've kind of upgraded the graphics a bit for that, which is nice.
2's fantastic. 2's one of my favourite games of all time. I got the Trilogy Pack, and... Mm-hmm. Number 3 was pretty poor, unfortunately. It was not a good game, but number 2 is really, really good. Number 1, I think a lot of people who played on Xbox originally, for the original Mafia, or PS2, probably didn't expect... I know the game's a different game, it's a remastered game, but it's much closer to or the PC version originally was much closer to the open world that this game is. Mm-hmm. And I played it on the PC originally, so it's really good game, really good graphics, and also just really good... well-implemented story, which I think is not many open-world games really manage to get the story down. I think Rockstar do. Rockstar always seem to get the story elements done really well, and Mafia is similar to Rockstar in that respect. They've got the storyline properly down. Mafia 2's got a fantastic story anyway. Mafia 1, or Definitive Edition, also a fantastic story.
Sounds like we have to pick this up at some point. Really good. It's a shame that 3 isn't so great, though, but, you know, it's in there, I guess, so you play it at some point, maybe. Cool. Rob, what about you? What, have you picked anything Dreamcast-related up, or what are you playing at the moment?
No, I'm afraid I haven't picked anything up Dreamcast-wise, so can't really add anything in there. In terms of what I'm playing, I finished off Ghost of Tsushima, which I reviewed for T3, and then, you know, I played it all the way through, and... then I've been sort of doing all the extra sort of collectible stuff, you know, the sort of, I always think of Assassin's Creed, you know, that level of sort of like, oh, you finished the game, have you? No, you haven't. You've got to go and collect X, Y, and Z, and, you know, you've got to do these extra little bits. So I've been doing that. And then I've just actually run through Dishonored 2 again. I absolutely love Dishonored and Dishonored 2, the second one especially. I'm a huge fan of The Count of Monte Cristo, which is obviously what those games were based on. And the second one is just fantastic. So I've just done a no powers run through with Emily on a quite hard difficulty setting. But it was sort of maximum carnage. So there was no sort of stealth or anything. It was just, you know, just ripping through everybody. So that was a good laugh. How about you, Andrew? What have you been picking up / playing?
Well, I can't remember if the last time that I actually did this, because if I'm on, I'm usually hosting, and therefore I don't do this. I think the last thing I picked up Dreamcast related was, I've got a couple of friends who live up in Liverpool from the Crossplayers, and they happen to be good. I think this is a good few weeks ago before the local lockdowns came back into effect, and they kind of gone out and they went to this retro store, and there was so many Dreamcast games there, and there was some white label stuff there, which you don't generally tend to see very much in game stores. And he showed me what they had, and it was Echo the Dolphin and Soul Calibur white label. Mm-hmm. So it's like, yeah, I might as well get it. So I got those and He sent them over to me. I've sent Soul Calibur off to my nephew because I got him a Dreamcast for his birthday this year. He was like 11, I think, and I think that's like a good age to get him into Dreamcast. And he's been kind of interested in the book that I've done and everything like that. So he, there's another game to add to his collection for the Dreamcast, which is good. He's quite into Tekken as well, so I thought that Soul Calibur would be an interesting, different fighting game for him to try. And then Echo the Dolphin, which I haven't played yet, but it was one of the games that I've not really got on that well with in the past. But for a fiver and the white label version, I thought, yeah, I'll give it another shot once I get my Dreamcast plugged back into the TV. So that's kind of all I've picked up, really, in terms of Dreamcast stuff playing-wise. So I've been playing Resident Evil 7. Which is a pretty old game at this point, of course, but we're in October as we record this. And so Halloween, I thought I'd play a scary game. And I'm further than I got. So I originally got it with the intention of playing through the entire thing via VR. I get incredibly motion sick and I could only do it in 20-minute bursts. So I think I got 2 hours in doing it in 20-minute bursts and had to stop because I got to a boss fight that was just beyond me. It's like 10 tries and I still couldn't manage it. I've now breezed past that. I've completely, I'm not playing it in VR now. I'm just playing it normally and got past it, and I'm a good hour to an hour and a half past that point now. So I feel like I'm getting somewhere with it, and my hope is that I can finish it by the time Halloween proper gets here, so the 31st, I'm hoping. Really enjoying it. Like, as people might know, I'm a huge Resident Evil fan, so I'm quite ashamed that I haven't finished this game yet, considering it's a big game in the series. So I'm very excited to get further in it. It's very, very interesting. I'm kind of very interested in the lore of this game and where the story is going to end up, because everything's still a little bit mysterious at this point. And the antagonists are absolutely insane. The screaming that Marguerite does as she chases you through the house, the name she calls you is terrifying, but yeah, it's great. Other than that, the only other game I've been playing, and I don't know if any of you guys have played this, but it's a title that is only just recently come to the public consciousness, I think, and that's something called Among Us. It's worthwhile. I mean, it's free if you get it on mobile. I mean, it has ads because it's, a mobile game, but you can pay to turn them off. But it's essentially kind of werewolf / mafia, not the mafia you're playing, but like the game that you'd play where you have to shut your eyes and you're in a circle in real life, when we could all meet up before everything happened. And you can shut your eyes and you choose somebody to kill. It's essentially kind of like that, but in video game form. So you are kind of like little weird creatures on a spaceship, and you all have to run around fixing the spaceship, doing your tasks. But one of the people among us, is an imposter and is actually trying to sabotage the ship and kill you all. And you spend the whole game, basically, if you're the imposter, going around sabotaging things and picking off people one by one, and everybody else has to figure out who it is and throw them off the ship. And you can only talk when you have meetings, so when you find a body or when you press the big red button in the center table in the spaceship, you can only talk then and discuss amongst yourselves who you think is the imposter. It is incredibly good fun if you're playing it with friends, and I've discovered that I am actually quite a good liar, and I've talked myself out of being chucked out of the airlock a number of times while being the imposter. I think one of my oldest friends, Steve, who I do DCY with, he on a couple of occasions, he's used our 20-year friendship as his kind of get out of jail free card. Like, you can trust me, we've been friends for 20 years. And he was being genuine with it. So I was mean, and I used it back on him while I was the imposter. I was like, we've been friends for 20 years, Steve. Don't throw me out the airlock. You can't do this. And he saved me, and I was the imposter, and I felt very bad about it. But I won. So, that game brings out a bad side of me, I think. but I definitely say play it if you haven't played it. It's incredibly fun. And for a free game, it's worthwhile. Cool, okay. So that's pickups and what we're playing. Awesome. Next time, I promise I'll go back and I'll think of a really weird question just to throw you all off. So don't worry. I'll go back to normal next time. So as we mentioned at the beginning, this is Left in Japan special. And this is one that I know, Lewis, you were very keen on because you're such a huge fan of Japanese games and just weird, obscure titles, right?
Yeah, I like to try anyway. Not that I can play most of them because I'm lazy and don't put in the effort. But yeah, if it's weird, if it's Japanese, and I don't understand it. I want to understand it, basically.
Yeah, that's fair. And we kind of put a tweet out about this, and Rob, that's how you kind of realized we were going to make this episode, and this is also your jam, so that's why you're here, right?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, that's it, guys. I mean, like, that one of the main reasons, you know, back in the day that I really got into Dreamcast was Japanese exclusives and imports, and I don't have a massive collection now, but yeah, I was all up for this for sure.
Definitely. And Mike, we know you pretty much like any Dreamcast game because you've bought them all, so you know, you've got a great knowledge.
stick a swirl in it, I'll buy it.
Oh, that's a good business plan, actually. Anybody listening out there, put a swirl on it, Mike will buy it. Whatever it is, it's fine.
Other than Sega, of course, but that's another topic for this podcast.
Yeah, very true. Very true. But yeah, you do have, as Lewis has said many a time, you have an encyclopedic knowledge of Dreamcast games in general. So you're kind of almost the perfect person to have with us as we take this journey through Japanese games that have been left in Japan, essentially. The games that we're talking about haven't come to the West at all. This is going to be an interesting one. My personal experiences, I don't have a huge amount of experience with Japanese titles beyond big ones like, actually, no, I won't say because it'll spoil it for later. But, you know, there's some games out there that I've, one that we're probably not going to discuss, which doesn't need translation, to be fair, is Cosmic Smash that never came out in the West. Great game. And Cool Tune as well, which I got because I loved Space Channel 5 so much that I bought that, and you don't really need any translation to understand what's going on there. But that's my only real my knowledge of Japanese games is the stuff that were fun but didn't really need much in the way of translation to play. So what we'll do is we will go around in a bit of a circle and discuss, really. We've each picked two games, so I'm going to come to each of us in turn. We'll do one game each and then we'll go back around again. The person whose game it is will kind of have a bit of a description about what the game is and what they like about it, and then we'll just have a general discussion, and we've got some extra ones at the end that we can talk about as a group. So I guess the best place to start is probably with Encyclopedia Mike, and one of the games that we've that you're gonna, and I'm gonna absolutely butcher the name, and you can correct me as soon as I've said it, is Tsushin Taisen Logic Battle Deisessen.
That's how I would say it.
Okay, awesome.
Nice. I don't think Encyclopedic Mike is necessarily correct Japanese pronunciation, Mike.
No, we have Martin and Ross for that, right? That's a separate thing. Okay, cool. So what is this game then?
So I think it's very difficult to describe the game without sort of referring to other things. Okay. And the only way of really describing the game is to call it Battleships. Now, it's not Battleships. There are no ships involved. But it's a very similar sort of style of play. So basically you have a grid for yourself and a grid for your opponent. And then you put your soldiers on the grid in various different formations. You basically pick between 1, 2, 3, and 4 soldier formations. You can pick them onto the grid you have, and you have a certain amount of points you can basically spend on putting those figures onto your map. Your opponent is the same, without you knowing, and your basic aim is to then bomb the other side without seeing what's actually going on, and if you get a hit, you can carry on as normal. So it's basically Battleships. It's probably more akin to Battleships, some of those weird electronic Battleships variations you got on some of the Electronics Battleships board games. I don't know if anyone else had that as a kid, but I had a sort of electronic Battleships, and there was loads of variations you could do. So it's similar to that to an extent. It's all quite cutesy anime characters. It's all a little bit weird. I'm not really sure what's going on. It's quite bright and colourful. There's sort of little characters on an island. I'm not quite sure why the island's at war. I'm guessing some kind of, you know, inter-fairy warfare's going on. I don't know. I honestly don't. I haven't got a clue. But the game actually plays quite well. It's quite easy. There's a multiplayer mode as well, which is actually really playable. And it's just one of those games where, when I was going through the A to Z guide, I had to play through all of the Japanese puzzle games. And some of them are really, really easy to get into. Some of them not quite so much. And this one was one where I really didn't expect much. and it actually was far better than I thought. And it's a game that I've gone back to several times since, which is unusual for some of the puzzle games on Dreamcast, because some of them haven't really aged as well as maybe they should do. So it's a fun, bright, colourful battleship-style game, which is I think, I don't think I've seen anyone talk about it on the internet before, to be honest with you.
Interesting. I mean, so one of the reasons we're talking about Japanese games in particular, and these ones, there must be a reason that it was left in Japan, as it were, that it never came out here. Is there any particular reason that you can think of that this just didn't come to the West? Is it just too Japanese, perhaps, for Western audiences?
I think it's battleships. I think that's probably the reason why it didn't come to the West.
I think
in terms of the fact it's a bit basic, isn't it? It's quite a basic game, I think. Right. Especially with the Dreamcast, I think, you know, there was already a bit of a version to 2D gaming at the time in the West. I still remember some of those review scores in the Dreamcast magazines in the UK for, you know, some of the fighters and some of the shooters. So I think that was possibly one of the reasons. I don't necessarily think it would suit a Western audience massively well. It's very Japanese in its style. It's very, very cutesy characters, very bright, which is great in some occasions, but I think it's just a bit too... It's a bit too out there for a puzzle game like this, and a puzzle game which has battleships. The one reason this game is different than some of the other puzzle games is that there is a fair amount of text in the game. There's not a massive amount of text in terms of you can't play it. It's very playable, but there's a story there. There's lots of other things. So I think the amount of time it would have to involve to translate it, I don't think it would have actually given the developer any sort of profit back at all. It's developed by 45, who had a couple other games on the Dreamcast, who I won't mention in case they get mentioned later on. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there's well-known developer. I just don't think it would have necessarily suited the Dreamcast. I think maybe the PS1 budget title. It may have been released as the PS1 budget title for all I know. I don't think it was. But yeah, it's that sort of thing where it's got a cheap... Again, I say cheap. I'm making the game sound awful. Cheap as in it's not a kind of game which would be, you know, fly off the shelves in the UK.
Sure. It would cost more to sort out and put it into English language than it would probably make back, is what you said.
I think so. Yeah. But it's really cheap as well. Now, one great thing about these games, these puzzle games, is that they're not shooters, and Japanese Dreamcast games that aren't shooters or some fighters tend to be quite cheap. So this game is still pretty cheap to pick up. So it's definitely worth doing.
Yeah, it's I get what you mean. Yeah, it's not cheap, but it's you got two games you could buy in the store, and you've got, I don't know, Soul Calibur or this. You know, most people back then are gonna go for the, you know, cutting edge 3D graphics,
even Puyo Puyo or Mr. Driller. You know, I mean, they're more well known brands for a relatively obscure title with no sort of, you know, marketing behind it, name behind it. It would have been a pretty impossible sale, I think.
And also I've looked at some gameplay actually. I think I might pick it up actually because it does sound really cool. But like, there's a lot of like anime kind of graphics going on, and
yes,
I mean, if you look, everyone who's listening to this, look at the cover art. It's basically like these two, I suppose, what's the word, like chibi, like really young looking girls, and it's like no one
with
is
cat
gonna
ears.
Pick with cat ears. Yeah, it's very, very Japanese, very anime. When I was in high school, no one liked anime, and I can't imagine anyone liked anime in the West when this game came out. Hard sell. So unless they were to do like that kind of annoying thing that they did with a lot of games, like Gunbird 1 or something, where they like give it a ridiculous facelift, make it about like battleships maybe. But it's definitely a hard sell back then.
It would have been, wouldn't it? If it was released in the West, it would have had some kind of like weird soldier guy on the front of it, sort of with some kind of explosion going off outside of, you know, Dagenham or something. It's that sort of... There's no... I understand that the aversion some people have, mainly had rather than have, but towards these overtly Japanese titles, it is a bit of a weird culture shock for some people. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, it's just some of the times we get the Western versions of stuff, they're so anemic of personality. I think these kind of games, although they wouldn't have sold particularly well, I think we would have actually been talking about them now still as a Dreamcast podcast because of the fact it was so interesting and so different for us to play.
I think that if this game came out nowadays, you know, if an indie studio released a game like this, it'd be kind of like a sleeper hit or something. It'd be like, oh, this is a game you should have played. You know, this was actually pretty good, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did think with that, and I think it with quite a lot of sort of like these, I don't know how you describe them, but like, yeah, smaller, sort of more casual games. Like, I think of a lot of stuff on Saturn and Dreamcast, like I've got a fair few like pool games, you know, and the stuff that you now play on your mobile phone. And I think, you know, back then, like a full-scale release, it's almost like in the wrong time. Like, if you, I swear, like if you just pushed a lot of these games out, like you've just said, like with e-stores now on basically every console, you think about all the like the third party sort of like light titles that you even get on like the Nintendo Switch e-store and obviously on mobile phones. I think, yeah, you're right. I think it would have probably have got a lot more interest than it did back in the day.
Yeah, I think it is a really weird, it's a weird game, but it's a game which definitely I don't want to be lost to history. It's one of those games where no one's going to know about it if people don't actually keep playing it at some point. One thing I will mention, because I just looked it up now because I forgot, there actually is another version of the game, which is actually one of the Hello Kitty games on Dreamcast. Hello Kitty Garden Panic, which I think came with the consoles itself. It's basically a Hello Kitty rebranded version of the game, which is quite interesting.
That is interesting. Wow, okay.
So, Mike, you're saying that comes with the gorgeous Hello Kitty console that everyone secretly wants.
It does indeed come. I believe it comes with the Dreamcast Hello Kitty consoles, which I have, but neither of mine have the discs with them. So I'm not entirely sure.
I mean, obviously I know we've done this game, we've spoken a lot about this game, but like maybe you could have maybe released it back then. Hello Kitty branding might have been interesting, but.
Another year of Dreamcast, we would have had these kind of titles coming through. I think because when it ended, I think it was, to an extent, one of the reasons Dreamcast's popularity is so good is that we had quite a few big name games. We didn't have quite so much of the filler. For the sheer fact that the Dreamcast library wasn't around that much in the West, so we didn't have as much filler. So I think maybe, it would have come maybe a year, 2 years later.
Interesting. Yeah, that's been good. And I watched the video in advance of obviously it's recording this, and it did look like it's the most Japanese game I think that you could possibly ever, you know, that the anime characters and everything is just, it's completely out there, but it looks like a game that I would very much like to play. So I may also have to track this down. For those listening who want to also track this down, that is Tsushin Taisen Logic Battle Daisessen, I think.
That's the price of the game gone up.
Yep. Let's keep an eye on that. Dreamcast Junkyard effect. Let's have a look.
I just see like loads of people just, like listening to this. They go straight to eBay or their auction house of choice, and it'd be this like 150 quid or something. And you're like, damn you, Junkyard, damn you.
So some scalper somewhere just like looks at his shelf. He's like, oh, I've got that one. Straight on eBay.
Well, let's see if the next game is going to make it onto that list as well. So the next game we're talking about, Lewis, this is one of yours.
Yeah.
And this is Princess Maker Collection, which I think collects Princess Maker 2 and 3, is that right?
Yes. Really, though, I think most people remember Princess Maker 2. I think Princess Maker 3 is not as beloved sort of, I suppose, nowadays, you know, when people talk about this series, which these are ports of MSX games. I think they're also on the Saturn. I think they're on all consoles. I think they're on the Super Nintendo at some point as well. And this is the collection that was put, you know, on the Dreamcast in Japan. So the first, we started off light. We're going straight in. This is a game where you raise a child, basically. Has a very heavy medieval Europe vibe to it. Obviously, mixed with 2D anime artwork. It's very kind of, I think we've discussed before, Mike, that quite often people lazily just call anything that would seem like this as just visual novel.
Yes.
Don't think it really is a visual novel, but it kind of has elements of it. Yeah, it's more of a like a time management sim. So basically the plot is you're this famous warrior who is visited one day by a god who says that they need to raise a child of the heavens from age 10 to 18, like you do, like, you know, only natural. And so you basically manage the schedule of this child as she grows older. You manage stuff like part-time jobs, schooling, their free time. There's an adventure mode as well, which functions as like a turn-based RPG, so you actually move her around like a map and attack enemies, and with the outcome being that you want her to have the best possible job. So basically how well you've done is based on the job she gets at the end by at 18. When I was researching about this, I found that the game has 74 possible endings. Wow. Based on how well you do, and there's like ridiculous endings. You can be like an absolute upstanding citizen in society, or if you're really shit, she can basically rack up too much sin and become the demon queen of darkness.
Just like real life. Just like real life.
Just how people turn out in real life. Obviously, you want to make her happy, because that one's considered a bad ending, believe it or not. I think the closest thing on the Dreamcast to this is the Chows in Sonic Adventure 1 and 2, or even maybe The Sims later on, you know, managing people's lives and, you know, what they do and how it kind of feeds into their aspirations and
giant
who
killers.
They become.
Giant killers. Yeah. It's basically Football Manager with Japanese princesses.
Yeah, exactly.
That's basically what it is.
But yeah, it's really interesting just how, you know, everything you do feeds into these stats that are just constantly at work in the background in the game. And like, it's quite intense from the sounds of it as well, because she can, the princess that you're raising can become stressed and even die if you don't do your job properly. So yeah. Yes, very stressful. And it kind of makes me wonder who wants to play a childcare simulator is what I'm asking. You know, who wants to escape the stresses of, you know, their job, their 9-to-5, and come home, maybe have kids as well, and then play this? That's my question.
Let me introduce you to the internet, Lewis. I think you'll find there's lots of weird people online.
Yeah. I mean, why didn't this come out here then? Why? I wonder why. Why did this not come here? If there's so many weird people, it's innately Japanese, right? It's very much a Japanese culture thing, is it not? This kind of game, it's inherently Japanese. I would say.
It displays a naivety which I don't think the West has, does it really?
Mm.
I think we sort of look at these games as being, rightfully or wrongfully, quite pervy. And I don't think they are. They're not. And I think problem is that it's a very, it's different sort of culture. It wouldn't have worked as a retail release. I'm pretty sure they've got, and I'm sure Lewis will be able to correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure there is English translated versions of the older titles.
Yeah, so they're actually on Steam now. So this was actually how I found it out, because someone, I think it was a year or so ago, they reviewed this, and I was like, oh, that's, what, you know, that's on the Dreamcast. And so, you know, if you want to play it, you can get it on Steam.
I would say that unlike the last game, the Dreamcast version, pretty much impossible to play.
Yes.
Unless you know Japanese. I mean, it's literally, there are some guides available. There was a good guide on one of the sites on the internet. It was a good guide on there, but it's properly difficult to get into. It's kind of one of those games where I think some of the games we're discussing today are games that are fully playable. This is one game which is definitely not playable unless you are really, really patient.
Yeah.
Or can speak Japanese.
Definitely get the Steam version, I think. Because it looks nicer. They added voice acting in, I think. There's all these extra bits. So that's probably the one to go for instead of sitting in a trying to translate the Dreamcast version. You know, it's a really interesting game. There's a bit of a cult following that's sort of appeared around it. You know, I think it's one of those games that's just naturally interesting. You know, if you give it a try, you know, you're gonna play it, you're gonna keep progressing through it. And unfortunately with this game, you're you're probably going to end up failing the first time, because it's one of those things where you have to really learn the ins and outs and the intricacies and what does what with these stats. So yeah, it's an interesting thing.
Rob, will you pick this one up?
I do love my management stuff. I'm definitely into Football Manager. I'm also into, you know, you'll find stuff back on the Dreamcast Junkyard, you know, quite a lot of sort of Japanese visual novels and the dating sim. I remember writing up about Key to E, White Illumination, because again, exactly what you guys have said, you know, like there is this perception in the West that all those sort of games, the visual novels, the dating sims, these sort of management sims, they're all a bit dodgy, but actually a hell of a lot of them aren't. They're just very normal. Yeah. And it is a sort of a different culture. So I think it's more the time aspect for me that is probably why I won't end up picking this one up. But it sounds interesting. It does.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, anyway, moving on. Rob, your first pick, the one I'm coming to first, is it looked quite interesting to me when I watched the video for it, and that is a game called Rainbow Cotton. So what turned you on to this game, Rob?
Okay, so the thing that turned me on to Rainbow Cotton is the fact that I'd had previous with the Cotton franchise or series on the Neo Geo Pocket and the Saturn, various games. And if anyone doesn't know sort of the Cotton series, it's basically a side-scrolling shooter, but very cutesy. You basically play, again, this quite, you know, I don't know if you call a schoolgirl age witch, but she's like a young witch. And it's, you know, those games, the games that I played before I got, you know, sent on to Rainbow Cotton, they were side-scrolling shooters. You know, left to right, loads of colour, loads of sort of like cute kawaii stuff, really sort of visually and audibly really sort of exciting. But Rainbow Cotton's completely different in many regards, because it's not a side-scrolling shooter. It's like a Space Harrier sort of fly into the screen sort of shooter. It retains all the sort of the cutesiness, and one of the reasons that I first got drawn to it is just how well it runs on the Dreamcast. Like, I'm a huge like bore when it comes around to like frame rates. Like I don't really care so much about resolutions, although that, you know, they're very nice to have, and it's one of the reasons why I like the Dreamcast. And I think I said this on the last pod, so many Dreamcast games run incredibly well, and this one is one of them. I don't know what the frame rate is, but it's buttery smooth basically for everything in the game. But I chose this one because I think it's a game where, you know, we're talking about certain games can, you know, would be really difficult to bring out of Japan, maybe because of the language barrier or because of this the culture barrier that we've just been discussing. And others, a bit like this one, like, you can literally bang it in the system and you don't need to know loads of Japanese, and it's very arcadey. Like, it's really just like an arcade flying to the screen shooter.
Yep.
So for me, it just felt like, I think it's a missed opportunity in two senses. Like, one, I think it was a missed opportunity because, for me, it, in my mind at least, it communicated everything that I thought the Dreamcast was, and I thought it would do well in the West. You know, it's bright, colourful, ran well, like visually very spectacular, specifically if you've got like the VGA, you know, set up. And also, I thought it's a bit of a missed opportunity because as anyone who's played it will no doubt attest to, there are numerous issues, you know, which sort of really hamper it from being like a really, like, you know, if these issues didn't exist, then it would be like one of the first games that I would recommend someone to play on the Dreamcast, but with them, then it's not. It's sort of like a flawed game. And the biggest one of those, without being about the bush, is the control mechanism. I mean, I don't know if any of you guys have played it. Maybe you want to sort of weigh in here.
Yeah, I'm sure you're going to a far more eloquent description than I will. But yeah, the controls and the fact that you get in the way of your own targeting system is slightly annoying in a game.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, How can I describe it? So you've got your analog stick and you're flying into the screen, and how the game works is like there's just like color and noise and like madness going on all over the place, and it's really hard. It's like almost like a bullet hell shmup from back in the day, where it's really hard to keep actually what was going on. What are your bullets? What are the bullets coming at you? There's a billion enemies on screen, and it's not quite so frenetic, but just like there's so much going on. And every time you move this, so you've got your analog stick and you're moving it, and obviously when you move, the cotton on the broomstick moves, but when you release the stick, instead of staying where you were and aimed where you were, it auto-centers and brings you back to the middle of the screen. So in order to shoot off or move in any direction, you've got to constantly have the thumbstick under pressure. And when there's a billion different enemies on screen, and or when you're trying to dodge obstacles, because that's another thing that can kill you, it's really, really frustrating. Really frustrating. Honestly, if they just nailed that control scheme, I think even if they just had it so it didn't auto center, it would be infinitely better. But as it is, yeah, you've got to really wrestle with the control scheme to sort of get anything out of it. So yeah, I think it could have done well. I think it could have done well if it was, one, a better game, and two, if they'd actually brought it over, because there's nothing really to stop them bringing it over. There's no barrier.
It's a really nice looking game, and actually, yeah. I mean, I want to say maybe because the character is an anime character, you know, that's like the thing I can think of. But really, the colors, the sort of magic theme, it's not that far off Nights into Dreams, really.
That's true.
Like, if you look at the boss that's like this giant frog, you know, I could see knights fighting against something like that. Yeah. You know, I could, yeah.
I don't think any of the Cotton games got ported, did they? I'm trying to think if any of the Cotton games got ported at all, which is really weird because they're quite, you know, they're sort of quite appealing games to the West, I think, the sort of Halloween-y themes to it. I remember playing this game first time. I've always sort of wanted to play Panorama Cotton on the Mega Drive. And obviously this is sort of the sequel, it's not really a sequel, but sort of the next 3D Cotton game. And I played the Panorama Cotton using the Mega Everdrive many years ago. And I played this, and I was really disappointed, as Rob has described perfectly. It's basically one of the most disappointing moments when you get this game. It looks amazing. It looks stunningly fast, smooth. It looks really, really colourful. And then you control it, and it's just like, ah, that's not right. And it just doesn't feel right at all, which is really, really disappointing, because it's a really interesting game to look at.
Yeah. I hadn't thought of that. I agree with you, Mike, because you're agreeing with me. but I think... I hadn't thought of that knight's sort of comparison, but I would say like that knight's aesthetic. This game is like Panzer Dragoon, but with a knight's aesthetic thrown all over it, but with an awful control scheme.
Well, I mean, so I'm going to ask the question here, because I looked at the video of this game, and it looked very appealing. The control scheme issues you brought up kind of put me off slightly, but, you know, it might be a game that I wouldn't mind picking up at some point. I'm sure some of the listeners would. Do we know if this is one of the cheaper options?
No,
it's not.
No, absolutely not.
Okay.
I don't think any Cotton game is cheap.
You're right, absolutely, like, no Cotton game, and I know that very well. Even the Neo Geo Pocket title, which, you know, is like, visually nowhere near, basically, any of the other Cotton games, still, we are talking hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pounds.
I think it is the cheapest Cotton game. I'm trying to think. Panorama Cotton's £300, I think. I think the Neo Geo Pocket Color is probably £500 at the current time. It's really expensive. And the Saturn games, so there's two in there. The Saturn, Cotton 2 and Boomerang, is it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And I think they're both £150 to £200. Last time I checked, and the prices on Dreamcast games have gone up so much this year, I'm losing track myself. I think Rainbow Cotton goes for about £100 to £150 at the current time.
Ouch. So you're going to have to really want to play that game to buy
it. That's it. It's so tough. Well, that or just rip it and, you know.
Exactly, yeah.
Play it yourself, yeah.
Well, that's what I did with the Neo Geo one. I recently picked up the Neo Geo Pocket Color SD.
Oh, yes.
Cards.
I just was playing it on that, and I was playing it and I thought, this is fun, but I would not pay all that money for it. I'm really glad that I just put it on this SD card reader.
Yeah, I don't want to get back into another conversation about kind of keeping physical games alive and preservation and stuff, but it's, yeah, when you get to that kind of situation where you're having to pay hundreds of pounds just to play a game that looks interesting, it's definitely off-putting. And that's why we have things like GDMU, I suppose. So there you go. That's one way to play it. If you can get past the control scheme by the sounds of it, it sounds like it might be okay. All right, let's move on then to one of my picks, which is, I mentioned basically my choice is because I don't have a huge amount of knowledge or experience with Japanese games. So my picks are basically coming down to ones that I really like the look of, or ones that I've briefly played and want to play more of, but can't because I can't speak Japanese. So this one is one that I've looked at and would really like to play, but I just haven't had the chance yet. And that is El Dorado Gate 1-7. The whole series, counting it as one game, because it kind of is really. This game, as soon as I saw it, I think I caught a glimpse of it in a magazine back in the day. Like, it might have been DC UK, it might have been the official Dreamcast magazine, but one of those magazines had I think it was like one, maybe two images of El Dorado Gate, and it was this cool new RPG that was coming out in Japan, completely 2D. It's gorgeous art style, really nice by Capcom. Great art style, and it was going to be a series of games where you played different characters in each one, and the kind of the story would come together. And it was a turn-based battle system. I think it's the old school style of battle as well, where you were facing the enemy rather than it being side-on, like in the later 2D RPGs. It looked phenomenally good for a 2D RPG. It looked like kind of almost the pinnacle in those days of what a 2D RPG could look like, because the graphics were just so colorful, bright, vibrant, well done overall. And I always wanted to play it, and I was so gutted that it never came to the West. I think in previous episodes I've talked about wanting to own it and wanting to get the box that came with it, because that was just such a cool collector's item. And I do own the first game. I bought it at, I think it was Play Expo a couple of years back, the first game, and it's all still wrapped because there's absolutely no point in me taking it out and putting it in, because I'd have no idea where to start. I'd need to get the guide out, and I don't have time for that these days. So I guess I understand why this was left in Japan, because it is incredibly text heavy, would require a lot of translation, and RPGs perhaps were not the thing that the Dreamcast was known for, and certainly they weren't as popular here in the UK especially, and just the West in general. So I get it, but I'd have liked to see it.
I suppose it's also 2D as well, whereas at the time we were pushing towards Final Fantasy, and I mean the RPGs on the Dreamcast, you got Grandia, Skies, they're big 3D RPGs. And also I don't even know how well it sold in Japan, but the sort of box set concept was, to be honest, it's probably a weird concept now to sell a game in seven parts. And obviously with the Dreamcast maybe not being as picked up in the West as it was in Japan, maybe they didn't think it was worth bringing it over because people may not have taken the chance on it.
I think Japanese had these kind of serial release a fair bit, didn't they? I know that obviously since then, obviously Telltale Games and stuff have brought out several part games that's worked pretty well. But I think if it had been released, I think I have a vague memory and reading in one of the magazines, possibly DC UK, possibly Dreamcast Monthly, saying that there was going to be a compilation of all the games coming out. So whether that was ever on the cards realistically, because I don't imagine each game fills the entire disc. I can't imagine it would do. So it'd probably be like a 3-4 disc collection. Mm-hmm. That would have been quite interesting. I think that would have gone down relatively well. But as Lewis said, 2D gaming at this point, some of the classics that we talk about now and go for hundreds and hundreds of pounds actually were torn apart in reviews at the time.
Mm. Yeah, it's a shame though, because I do agree that the art style on this looks absolutely gorgeous. Just stunning. And I think from everything I can see, there looks like so much RPG goodness in there. Yeah. But it's just, launching so late, 2000, as you say, times have moved on, but I don't know. I think the most interesting thing is what you guys have just mentioned for me. It's that serialization. And Mike, you're right. I mean, like, the Japanese definitely do have a bigger thing for serializing stuff that never really caught on over here. Maybe a bit more now. I mean, I suppose you're seeing it more now, actually, in terms of like when they have seasons in games, you know, like Fortnite season 3 or whatever.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it does exist, but those physical releases, I mean, like, I would love Kevin Keegan style to see what the sales numbers were for those games and how they, I'm presuming they tailed off, but if there's, how many are there? 7 in the set?
Yeah.
And they've been released every couple of months?
Yes, 2 months, what? Yeah.
Every 2 months, what is it? That'd be like 40 months.
It was a lower amount. It wasn't a full amount either. I think, if I remember rightly, it was, I don't know what the yen was at the time, but I think it was sort of midway between budget and full price. As I've said in the podcast before, I played through the first three or four volumes of this game using the guide. The guides available are fantastic. The online guides are really detailed. They're really, really useful, and it gives you enough freedom to still explore the games. They are definitely worth it. But yeah, I think it's one of those series of games where the prices have gone up as well. So the later in the volumes you get, the more expensive they are. The entire box set with the box, you know, you're looking at £300-400 at the current time in the UK, which is a lot of money to basically print out a guide from the internet and look at it whilst you're playing the game.
Yeah. It's another one that GDMU is good for if you really want to crack through it, I suppose. Yep. But knowing that in a magazine somewhere it was suggested that the West might have got a compilation of the 7 titles in some form, it's these kind of things that make me really wish that the Dreamcast had like the extra year or two to get these games over here, because you know, if Sega had said, fine, we're going to discontinue, but you know, we're going to support the console for the rest, you know, for the end of its life, give it a good 5 years, let it kind of simmer down and then leave it at that. I understand why they didn't do that, because money, you know. But also, you know, people miss out. It's almost like the today's equivalent is Netflix cancelling a show 2 seasons in without giving it a proper ending. Sega did that to us with the Dreamcast, and it sucks.
I think the thing as well is the game is a Capcom game. And if I remember rightly, Capcom at the time had a deal with Virgin, possibly with ADOS. I'm not quite sure who they had a deal with at the time. But I think this kind of game would have been hard to sell to a publisher they were working with in the Europe, who were in the West, who were sort of used to Capcom bringing out sort of, especially on Dreamcast, arcade style games. To try and sell this 7-part RPG series may have been an interesting conversation.
Yeah, I could see that. I mean, you know, it's a 2D game. They wouldn't be adverse to that, because Capcom has a history of 2D games. Street Fighter sells incredibly well. Yes, it's not a fighting game, but if they could do it as one release, you know, just a one-off release, not the 7 parts that they did in Japan, that could have been an easier sell. I mean, I don't know. You know, maybe it's to do with the number of discs it would need to be on, and therefore the packaging and the price that they would cost to make it.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, these days, I mean, if we were to think of this now, this would be a game that you could easily translate and put out there, and a lot of people would play this, I reckon. I mean, if you put the time into translating it, you could put this on Steam, like they did with Princess Maker. You could put it, you know, on consoles and, you know, just as a digital download. Yeah, Switch game. People would buy this and play it, because this is the in thing now, isn't it, right? It's going back to the past, playing 2D games, having these, you know, simpler games in terms of graphics, that still deliver that deep experience that people are looking for. You know, that pixel art has exploded, and to have a game of this quality, I think would do really well. So if Capcom are listening, get somebody to translate this and put it on Switch and PC, and it would be worth it. Do it.
Cool.
of course, Capcom didn't listen to this, but you know. All right, shall we move on to the next pick then?
Mm-hmm.
That is, we're going back to Mike, and Mike, your second pick is Tokyo Bus Guide. I can pronounce this one. Tokyo Bus Guide. Can you explain to us what this is all about?
So weirdly, when I was picking games I wanted to feature on this podcast, I ended up picking 2 45 games, as in the developer 45. Mm-hmm. But you can't really get a game as different from Dissessen than this game. Tokyo Bus Guide is pretty well known. It is a bus simulator, simply put. But it's not a kind of a crazy taxi stroke 18-wheeler type game where you sort of careen down arcade-style races. This is a proper sim sim game, which obviously is very popular in Japan, popular in the UK and Europe and the West now as well, of course. We've seen all these 4 million bus simulators and crane simulators, and I don't know, there's thousands of them. I think it's always been a bit of an appeal to people to have these kind of weird immersion games. But Tokyo Bus Guide's a really interesting example of this. It's, I think up to that point, the Dreamcast is probably the first 3D console which could give really, not lifelike, because it's not lifelike, but really clean visuals. I saw in an interview on YouTube a couple of days ago, someone mentioned the fact that one of the appeals of Dreamcast was that it was the first time that you could see games looking like they were clean, they were sharp, on a console at least. So I think this is one of the real benefits of this game, is that you basically drive around several routes in Tokyo, and you basically are in control of the bus. So you stop at bus stops. You have to actually stop on the bus stop. If you go over the line, you get sacked. You don't get sacked, but you get I think you might get sacked actually. You have to look in the wing mirrors. You have to look in the sort of the rearview mirror to make sure that the passengers are all there and okay, and they get on the bus and they pay the money. You have to make sure you're on time to avoid the traffic. You have to go these weird routes. Obviously, everything's mapped, everything's there to look at, but it's quite difficult to do if you're not versed in Japanese. I imagine it's very similar to if you were an English bus driver and you went to Japan and was just thrown to a bus without any sort of comprehension of the language. You know, there is quite a lot of things to learn, but it's certainly playable. And it's just a bit charming and a bit sort of, it's a bit out there for the Dreamcast. There's not really many games like it, apart from the Train Simulator, whose name I can never pronounce, so I won't bother. There's not really much like it. So it's a really cool, fun little game, which is probably not the greatest game on the Dreamcast. It's definitely not the greatest game on the Dreamcast, but it's just so weird. And I think the popularity of those simulator games in the last few years from the German developers is made this kind of game way up there now, and a lot of people are aware of it. I think if this game had come to the West, well, it wouldn't have come to the West. I mean, that's a simple answer. But if it had come to the West, I think it actually would have had a pretty big cult following. I think it's unfortunately the sort of game which would probably get a budget release on the PS1, that style of game, because it's sort of out there. I think some of the train, is it A-Train, whether the Japanese train simulator game in Japan called, which came to the PS1, I think. But yeah, it's just a really fun game, and it works really well as well. One of the great things about this game is that it works well. It feels like you're driving a bus. It doesn't feel like you're it's a made-for-gaming experience. It's just basically a proper simulator. Toned down, obviously, a little bit for consoles, but it just plays really well, and it's a nice change of pace to other games on Dreamcast. You know, I think I mentioned this on the last podcast as well. I love the sort of balls-out arcade thrills of the Dreamcast, but sometimes you want something a bit more leisurely. So this is basically sort of like, you know, the complement to Shenmue.
I was just going to add in regards to probably why this didn't come to the West. Well, obviously the location of the game, probably, you know, they're not familiar locations to people. Obviously the buses run differently in some ways. I mean, not that dissimilar. I mean, I went to Kyoto and my dad stood near the bus driver, sort of waiting, wanting to pay, and the driver like ushers him like down the bus, because the rule is that you pay when you get off, which kind of makes more sense really, because you pay you know, where you decide to get off. So yeah, there's a little bit, everything's a little bit different. Like the roads probably aren't as familiar to us. I don't know. But yeah. And obviously, like you said, Mike, the simulator games are popular now, but I don't know, like obviously there was, you know, Flight Simulator and all these different games back then, but now it's almost kind of like, I don't know how to explain it. It's kind of like an ironic thing now. Mm-hmm. Like people love playing, like, you know, Euro Truck Simulator, and it's kind of like this sort of nudge, wink, wink kind of attitude with it. It's like, yeah, like that's a really relaxing game, but it's a game I should like, you know.
I get what you're saying. But I think to an extent, that's probably down to people like us gamers who sort of think that. I think, my wife worked in game for a long time, and I worked in a shop which sells games as well. And actually, the people who buy them don't tend to do it on a sort of ironic level. It's actually, they're actually people into really heavily into these games. There is a subset of people, and me and Rob, I'm sure, are the same in terms of Full Manager games. You know, we sort of spend hours and hours and hours eclipsing every other game in time we have, literally guiding around imaginary players around imaginary fantasy football worlds that make no sense. I mean, to some of you who don't like football, I'm sure that sounds like absolute torture.
Yeah. Can I just say one more thing that is sort of testament to why people should check out this game? A bit like what's just been mentioned, like I've been to Japan multiple times, but one of the times I arrived at Haneda Airport, and I wasn't thinking at all and went out, and I decided to take the bus into town, and I got on the bus, and it goes around the various terminals, and then it was literally coming out of the Haneda Airport sort of like wider complex, the wider road network, and I was looking out the window, and I came to this, it stopped at this set of lights, and there was this crosswalk and building here and playing field here and this sort of metal fence down the left hand side, and suddenly in my mind I went, it's Tokyo Bus Guide, because my mind suddenly went, bam, you've seen this before, even though at that time I'd never taken the bus out of Haneda Airport before, but I'd seen it on Tokyo Bus Guide. And it just shows you that, honestly, I think it does. I think Mike mentioned it earlier. It does a pretty faithful job, you know, in recreating parts of Tokyo, obviously in a sort of compacted scale, but you know, the clean graphics, and you can see everything. And guess what? You know, certain parts of Tokyo, i.e. round major sort of destinations like the airport, haven't been developed since this game was made. So they look exactly the same, or very close to, you know, the same today.
That's quite a funny story. I had a similar thing when I went to Alcatraz with my family, and my mum goes, oh, where's the courtyard? That's where we should go next. I go, oh, it's this way. And it's because I played it on Tony Hawk's Pro Skater 4. It's like, it's honestly, other than the quarter pipes and the half pipes and the grind rails, it's pretty faithful, the level in Tony Hawk's Pro Skater 4. So,
humorously enough, when I went to Disneyland Paris, I realized that the game Disneyland Adventures is nothing like the park at all. And so we spent lots of hours walking around not knowing where we were going.
I like that. The antithesis of what you've just said, and that's amazing. So yeah, this I can't say this appeals to me, but I think that kind of genre of game definitely has exploded in recent years, like you said, Mike, and even I have been caught up with it. Like me and my partner bought, is it PC Builder, something like that. Bought that, and we're like putting PCs together, putting graphics cards in, making sure they worked. And it's like, you know, the reason people do this is because it's stuff that you can't generally do in real life. Like, you can build a PC, sure, but you can't just continually build loads and loads of upscale PCs because it costs money. You can't just drive a bus in Tokyo because you haven't learned how to drive a bus. You know, you can't go taking truckloads of stuff anywhere because you've not had your truck license. I mean, most recently, me and Tom have both been playing SnowRunner, which is, a fantastic simulation game, you know, completely properly simulating trucks and pickups and the physics of the mud and the snow. It's brilliant. A few years ago, like you mentioned, people would have probably kind of laughed at that and said, why are you doing that? You know,
I think that's because for a while, wasn't it, games became this sort of games went back to being games, if you know what I mean, in terms of it was more about the gameplay only. You know, it was about sort of, you know, online multiplayer and that sort of the it didn't matter what the game was set, almost, it was the experience was that part of it. I think people realized actually not everyone wants to have multiplayer games all the time, not everyone wants to do this sort of continuous sort of competitive gameplay. They just want sometimes just to sit back and have a nice casual game of something which is based on real life, but something you'll never do. You know, like Football Manager, like riding the bus around Tokyo, like I don't know, driving a tank through an orphanage, whatever, it's that sort of thing.
Let's hope that nobody actually in real life drives a tank through an orphanage. That would be not good.
Not again, anyway.
No, not again. No. All right, Mike, let's leave it at that. We won't go into to when you've done that.
No, I'm allowed to speak about it. It's fine.
That's fine. You've served your time. We'll leave it at that. Next up is Lewis again, and a bit of a spooky game, I think, from what I can gather. This is Despira. Is that right? Or Despiria, sorry?
Despiria, yeah.
Dysperia.
I don't know if spooky is the way to describe Dysperia. It's kind of spooky. I imagine skeletons dancing around happily, whereas this is not that. this is a weird game. One of only two Atlus games to be released, but I believe the other is Mac and X, which we obviously got in the West, but we never got Dysperia. And I think anyone who's listening to this who does not know this game, just look up some gameplay footage and you'll confirm pretty much immediately why we never got this in the West. So it's an RPG with adventure style elements. So when we're talking RPG, we're not playing it safe with a sort of a typical fantasy RPG story like Final Fantasy or Grandia 2. This is a post-apocalyptic cyberpunk horror thing, which takes place in 2070. World War 3's happened, and you work for this organization that's sort of infiltrating an evil organization called Church, and the main character, Allure, or on one of her missions, she is on a train. The train crashes, and she's in this dark, dingy underground tunnel maze system. So that's basically where the game takes place, in this like sort of really claustrophobic maze underground. It gets compared a lot to Shin Megami Tensei, which, if you know Persona, that's a big series from Atlus. Instead of summoning demons in this game, you use monsters in Allure's mind, and you basically fight enemies in these like weird psychedelic psychic mind battles. And she can this is pretty gross, but yeah, she equips abilities by snorting like horrible parasite worms up her nose, which, wow. Like, you know, if you saw that in a Western game, people would just be like, what is this? But yeah, the adventure side of it reminds me very much of something like D, or there's another game on the Saturn called Tariko. This first-person view, you're moving from one static screen to another, and then on each screen there's like different things you can interact with. The reason it reminds me of these games is a lot of them haven't aged very well in the sort of 3D graphics department, but I think that's what makes this game so creepy now, is you know kind of like the 3D renders that maybe you see in the first Silent Hill. If you look at the manual of Silent Hill, these characters, they look very sort of anemic and creepy nowadays. Yeah. Like back then, probably they looked really good, but now that kind of 3D render style has aged quite poorly. And you know, I mentioned a game like Tariko on the Saturn. That game doesn't look that good now because it's just an adventure game and all the characters look really strange and it makes the game kind of creepy. But in the case of Dysperia being a horror game, it just amps it up to another level. Like everyone just looks really weird. And yeah, I love the way the graphical style is used. And actually it was a little bit dated even on the Dreamcast, but I genuinely think they did it for kind of a stylistic reason. So yeah, I mean, if you look up footage of this game, you're going to see a lot of grotesque imagery, sort of almost verging on like body horror in some cases, and it's definitely that kind of Japanese horror that people in the West find really weird and unsettling and very alien. So yeah, that's really why this is a good horror game. But unfortunately, it's never been brought over to the West, which is a real shame, because I think it could have a real cult following now if they brought it over.
I mean, if you look at it now as well, I mean, I've only seen videos of it, but not only is it very Atlus in the way that they do it, like you say, the powers used by snorting those things that he knows. Well, Persona, you use your powers by shooting yourself in the head.
That
Atlus are very known for, doing these very bizarre things, and people like that now. But not just that, and I don't know if I'm wrong in this assumption, not assumption, but this take on it, but when I looked at the footage of it, you were kind of doing the static screens and looking for things on the screens to highlight and interact with. It reminds me very much of those hidden item games that are extremely popular on like iPad and stuff like that now, where you have to try and find something within the environment or solve puzzles and stuff. So it feels like that in itself as well as the kind of people now getting the Atlus style more, it would probably work quite well. But the only thing holding it back, I guess, is it's quite heavily Japanese text based, right?
Yeah.
Also, it's batshit crazy.
Right. Yeah. Okay. I mean, you know,
very strange.
I think I agree with just what was said, though. Like, I think people are game for that. Like, there's a reason why Persona 3 is my favorite Persona game. I mean, like, I can never get that image of Yukari at the beginning of the game, literally in the opening cinematic, holding the gun against her head. Like, I think Atlus has made a name for itself in terms of gamers because it's buckets of style and edge, you know, and in everything, from the visuals to the music, to sort of the themes, to the, you know, like, as you said, like, I had not heard of this game, but yeah, like the psychic mind battles, I mean, it's very Persona. So I agree entirely. I think there'd be loads of people game to play this if they could today.
I think the game is worth pointing out that DC Collector, who runs a fantastic blog, and is a friend of the Dreamcast Junkyard. It's his favorite game, I believe, from when he voted in the poll. He loves this game, but I think one thing's really important, as I touch on what Rob's just said and what Lewis said, Japanese horror, I think, surpassed Western horror in the 1990s because they don't just go for, and this is all genres of horror, and whether it's any media of horror, I should say, they don't just go for the sort of the slasher type thing or lots of blood for the sake of blood or just things that are surface horror. They're very much, even on things like Resident Evil, one of the reasons Resident Evil is so popular, They really touch upon the psychological aspects really, really well. And Asperia, even though it's a game which I played and had no idea what was going on at all, I still felt creeped out by it, which is quite an achievement when you don't understand anything that's going on and yet you're still incredibly creeped out by it.
Definitely. It's quite an unusual setting for a horror game and RPG as well, like the post-apocalypse, 2070... being underground, the like you said, the psychic mind battles. I've not heard of a game with any of those things, you know. Yeah. Never mind just one of those things, any of those things, that it sounds so unique. And looking at it, I want to play this game. And are there guides for this game? Is this one that you can get a guide for, or?
There are guides, but I mean, they're not very good. It's a kind of game which I think maybe a guide would maybe not be that useful for in some ways. It's a kind of game which I think the experience would be dampened a little bit. I don't know. I played it with a guide. I played it with a translation guide, to be honest, more than a guide. I just played it with Google Translate. But I mean, it's very out there, and I think it would be a real struggle if you don't know at least a fair knowledge of Japanese to get any sort of distance in the game.
Okay, interesting. And is this one of those that's up there in price, or is this one that can be had a bit cheaper?
Nice and cheap.
Nice.
£5 to £10, I think, last time I checked. Yeah, nice and cheap.
Well then, that's
might
all right.
Be more expensive than that. It might be more expensive
last,
than that.
Last time I checked, it was like in the sort of 60.
There we
60,
go.
70 there we go. Range. That was recently.
Just let me change it on my A to Z guide.
The thing is, I don't know if that's just I looked at eBay and that was what came up, but you know.
When I bought it, I think I bought it about 10 years ago, when I started getting Japanese games. It was one of the games that always came up. It was one of those games that there was a few Japanese games every single day on eBay you'd have up there. Despair would be up there. July would be up there. A couple of games like that would always be up there. I think people sort of bought them on the premise that it looked really interesting and then they couldn't play them. But for a while it was sort of £10-15. I think it might have shot up a little bit since then. I may be getting confused price-wise with July as well. Because for some reason in my mind, even though they're completely different games, they do get mixed up in my mind sometimes.
Okay, fair enough. I was going to say, if it was £5 to £10, I could have dealt with that, and I maybe could have used the rest of the money to hire like an actual Japanese person to just sit and translate it as we played. You know, or got Martin to come over. Martin could translate for me. So, you know, Martin, there's an offer there. If we can get Desperia for about £10, fly over and you can translate it for me on the fly. Okay, so that is Desperia. Awesome. Next one on the list, one of Rob's again, and this one is LOL. Oh, yes. Not laugh out loud. This is Lack of Love. Rob, why have you picked this one?
What a game.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm going to try and, you know, not like undersell this, but yeah. Mike will know, and, you know, he can definitely get stuck in as well because he knows the score with this one. Yeah. So Lack of Love. How to start? Man, what a game. Okay, so Lack of Love. Let's start like fundamentally with what it is. Lack of Love is a game where the premise is a robot called Halumi is sent on a ship, like a terraform, well, not a terraforming ship, but like a sort of set up an ecosystem sort of ship to the far-flung parts of space. And within that, its mission is basically to sort of create life and create an ecosystem on these planets. I think the idea is that it's then going to be habitable for humans. Yep. Although I don't think it's explicitly said anywhere, even in the manual. And then what happens is you basically then play an organism from its most simple form. You're basically, I think the first form, well, I know the first form is a like a cell in an egg, or like the tiniest of creatures, sort of like in a pond, like you'd have like the origins of life. And then the premise of the game is from that point, you then symbiotically interact with your environment and other organisms to evolve. And each quote-unquote level, essentially, is you playing different forms of this organism. And you keep getting bigger and bigger, and your form changes. Everyone will probably be thinking now of Spore, mm-hmm. Which came out much later than this, 5 or 6 years, I think. Yeah. And that's very similar premise to that, although obviously Spore had some different mechanics. Why this is so interesting is this was made by Love Delic, Kenichi Nichi, who along with his team there, which includes Ryuichi Sakamoto, yes, the great sort of like musician. He was fundamentally like a part of this, and he does the soundtrack for it. And I read an interview that really actually the concept of the game came from him. But the beauty of the game is that despite it being a Japanese exclusive, and despite it sounding like it should be very complicated, actually there's no language at all in the game. There's no written text. Like, yes, there's a manual, and there are brief, I will stress brief, Japanese instructions as to what the game is, what different things do. But it's very, very sparse. Everything is very sort of cut down in that respect. It's basically it's all about the experience that you go and do. So there's some basic commands. But the main goal is essentially to stay alive and to evolve. But crucially, to do that, the game basically, it doesn't push you all the time, but there's a really positive message in this game, because to actually evolve and to quote unquote beat the game, I don't even like using the word beat, because this is not a game you beat, you experience it. You have to work with other organisms. It's a really positive message. In most circumstances, you help them out, and you can do that in various ways. You know, like if it's like protecting them, it's showing them how to get food, access food, where water is, these sort of basic things. I mean, as an organism, specifically when you get some of the sort of the more evolved creatures, yes, you can eat other creatures if necessary, because there are mechanics in the game, like there are like health mechanics. And you do have to do basic things like resting, urinating, you know, like this is built into the game. It's about cycles. It's basically each level you're managing your cycles as this creature. You're trying to stay alive. And to do that, you're trying to create symbiotic bonds with other creatures. And the soundtrack is just sort of like, it's sort of electronica slash classical. It's a fantastic soundtrack. The soundtrack is available separately as well. It's something that I do listen to, you know, background normally while I'm working. It's sort of really relaxful, but it's also sort of like got a sort of an alien quality to it. It's very moody. It sort of translates, you know, the sort of the how, you know, it's almost like a I don't know how to describe it. Like the organism itself, it's like the miracle of life. You know what I mean? Like how hard it is for anything to survive and to live, you know, and I can't speak more highly of it. I mean, I've probably not done a good job here in describing it, but yeah, I picked this one because, my God, this should have come out of Japan. Yeah. And the problem is that everyone knows what the problem is. This doesn't fit into any genre. It's not, you know, white men with guns. It's not even, you know, for the Japanese taste. It's not even like shmup or a versus fighter. It doesn't fall into any of these bankable, you know, money-making, easy sell types of games. And it was just incredibly experimental. And a really experimental game. For me as well, again, this is something I've mentioned before, like the Dreamcast, and we're going to see that with the title coming after this one. So much creativity on show, and specifically towards the end with the Dreamcast. And this game is one of the most unique titles I've ever played on any console or on any PC at any time. Right. And I can't... Yeah. I'm gonna be quiet now. Mike, please get stuck in.
I think you've summed it up pretty much perfectly. It is really difficult to describe the game, isn't it? Because it's up there with Rez and Cosmic Smash for me as being a game which is so minimalist, so without language. So it transcends borders, it transcends language. It really is. It's a phenomenal game. It's up there with my three best Dreamcast games.
Wow.
It's just a really simple concept. It is similar to Spore in terms of its, you know, the story of evolution, but it's weird really because the Dreamcast has a couple of different games like that. We have Element, and we have another game which I can't remember the name of, Seventh Cross Evolution, which are both sort of similar sort of things, but Lack of Love is just so different. It's a really soothing game. It's, to me, there are elements where it's not soothing, but it's a really soothing, laid-back experience. And it's just, I always describe it as being the 2001 A Space Odyssey compared to the Star Wars of other games. It's not going to appeal to everybody. Not everyone's going to get it. But it's as an actual technical experience, as an actual gaming idea, I think it's probably one of the two or three games I've ever played in 30 years that have really just completely changed my expectations of what a game could be. Shenmue, funnily enough, was another game which did that for me in terms of the open world. But it's different than that. It's just so minimalist. It's basically... it's not minimalist in terms of graphical design necessarily. I'm not talking about the Rez Cosmic Smash style minimalism. I mean minimalism as in there's no instructions. There is nothing, you know, it's not a case where you have a tutorial. It's not a case where you have to, you know, sort of mission goals. It is very, very, you really do experience the life of what this creature goes through. Mm-hmm. And it's a really weird experience. It is possibly the hardest game to describe ever. I do feel for Rob having to describe it because it is a really difficult game. And the music as well. So I'm not usually into this sort of style of music necessarily. I have a standalone soundtrack as well. And it is my by far and away my most played soundtrack on Dreamcast. It is just absolutely... everything about it is just absolutely stunning. And I think it's a game which everyone should play. I think the Dreamcast Junkyard's article, if I remember rightly, was actually number one for quite a while. If you searched for Dreamcast Lack of Love, I believe our article was actually top. I'm not sure who wrote that article, whether it was Tom or Rob.
It was me.
It was you. I thought it was Rob. And it was the most, it was the big, the first search result. So hopefully quite a few people have discovered this game due to the Dreamcast Junkyard, which would be fantastic because it is a game which... truly deserves its position. One thing I will say is that on the Dreamcast Junkyard top 200 polls, this game got mentioned in the last two polls. It ranked 93rd and 113th. Mm-hmm. It is not a 93rd or 113th ranked game. It really is a top 10 Dreamcast game, but everyone needs to play it. It's a game which I don't care how you play it. Just literally burn a copy from the internet. Doesn't matter. And play it because it's up there with Shenmue in terms of how completely intriguing how experimental a game is and how different a game can be to what you're used to.
I just want to add, you know, this company who developed it, I think they were just really ahead of their time. Love Delic.
Yeah.
Just to sort of add on the end here is, you know, there could be even a possibility that we'd see Lack of Love ported to newer systems. This company developed a game on the PS1 called Moon, which has had a similar cult following. It's like this game where you go around picking up after an RPG hero that just slaughters all these monsters and you bring them back to life. It's like bonkers. It's like an anti-game, you know. That actually recently, since 1997, staying exclusively in Japan, they actually localized it and brought it out. So, you know, LOL would be even easier to bring to modern systems and sort of revitalize it and give it that attention it deserves. And I think the gamers of now would probably appreciate it, actually.
Yeah, it sounds like it. I mean, I was thinking throughout, and you said it, Rob, that a lot of people probably think it sounds like Spore. And from what I've seen of it and what you've described, it does sound a bit like that. And considering Spore came later, I wonder if they actually played this game and took any inspiration from it when they made Spore.
Yeah.
Be interesting if they did. But
what's interesting to very quick note, though, is the fact that where Spore, as you got further on in Spore, I found the game to become a little bit tedious. It sort of got into sort of real-time strategy elements and stuff, and it didn't work after a while. Lack of Love is almost like what Spore would have been if Spore had just stuck to its really cool idea.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. It sounds like one that I need to pick up. Sounds like one that everybody needs to pick up. But is this another one that's high in price, or are we looking at not too much for this one if you wanted to buy it physically?
I believe, and I'm sure I'm probably wrong again, but it's probably touching £90-100 at the current time.
Okay, interesting. But yeah, like you said, it sounds like one that people need to play. So however you play it, just play it.
Yeah.
So. Awesome. All right, the last game that's on our list, which is my pick, is one that I have played this game because it was so reliant on the Japanese language. There's only so much I could play, and I do find it difficult to use guides, and I find it breaks the immersion for a lot of games, this one being one of them, I think, for me. This is Sega Gaga, which I think, Rob, you alluded to as just before, as being such a creative title. It is... Excuse me. It is one of the games that I saw at the time, you know, the British gaming press, the DCUKs of the world, etc., showed this game towards the end of the Dreamcast cycle when everything was kind of, all hope was lost. We were all going to lose the Dreamcast and we're going to have to go on to other things because Sega was leaving the market. And here was this weird game in Japan that was coming out. It was obviously never going to come out here. It just wasn't going to happen. But this was a Sega game taking the piss out of Sega. Essentially, they were laughing at themselves. They were taking the mickey out of themselves. But also, on the flip side of that, it was a love letter to what Sega was and where it was at the time. As a console manufacturer, as a game producer, it's just this incredibly odd thing for them to have done. I mean, the Dreamcast era for Sega was possibly a lot of people argue over which era was Sega's most creative. I feel it was Dreamcast because of, you know, the breadth and the depth of the different types of games that we got, and the singular vision that they had with the blue sky aesthetic that actually came through so much of it. And then you've got Sega Gaga, which is almost like the rounding out of Sega in general. This was their swan song, really, as a console manufacturer. They released this game, which is a turn-based RPG / management sim, which has you take the role of this person who comes in to work for Sega and ends up taking over and coming up with different game ideas. And I think you end up having to go into the computer, right, to fight different versions of characters from Sega games in order to get them to be able to make games with them. I didn't quite get some of the story aspects sort of it, I kind of picked up little bits. But this is why I had issue with it, because there's so much story going on there, and I felt like I was missing a trick with it. And I see why it didn't come to the West, but also I really wish it had done. I mean, can anybody explain it a little bit better than I can?
Well, I'll have a crack. I mean, I'm not an expert. I mean, Mike, you definitely go after me as well. But like, Yeah, the fundamental, you play a guy actually called Sega, you know, like right. That's the one thing I'd say. Like, the game is just like you mentioned it. It's so like it's a love letter, but it also rips the piss out of like Sega and related properties like mercilessly.
Yep.
And you're sort of like part of, you're a recruit. You're recruited as part of like the I don't know if it's actually called the Sega Gaga program, but basically you're recruited to come in and save Sega. Because there's the evil rival companies, basically, like they've got, you know, like they're dominating and Sega's, you know, backs against the wall, which it was in real life. Like, it's incredible, really, when you think about it. And then, yeah, it's a mixture of like management where you've got to manage studios and produce games while also, as you mentioned, like fight characters. I think, you know, various different characters, both from sort of Sega characters as well as just sort of like generic Japanese sort of otaku type baddies.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a mixture of those two things. I think it gets more management as you go on, but that it's making it sound really dull. Everyone said management alone, I've just realized, but like, it's not. Mike, take over and say why it's not dull.
Why it's not dull. So it is ultimately a management and RPG game, but some of the reasons it's not dull. So you have loads of really amazingly hilarious references to Sega characters. The infamous Alex Kidd reference, working in a shop as a, you know, bedraggled sort of character forgotten by Sega is fantastic. They've got a shmup in there. I know some people don't like the word shmup, but there's a shoot-em-up in there, which is, I think, done by the same people who made Thunder Force. And it's absolutely fantastic. You fight against each boss, or each of the bosses you fight is basically different Sega consoles. There are loads of little mini-games. One involves having to stack Dreamcast console boxes up. There are just loads of really amazingly cool references throughout the entire game that you can collect previous Sega releases and put them onto like a sort of a gallery shelf that you have as you collect them. There's loads of references to Sony, Nintendo in sort of, you know, tongue-in-cheek references. I played through the entire game with a guide. I know that obviously there's a guide still ongoing for a full video playthrough done by Ross, one of the fellow Junkyard members. But it is playable with a guide. You do obviously miss out a little bit, but all of the references you understand, and to be honest with you, it's definitely worth playing. It is a game which I would 100% say, if you are a Sega fan, to play through. There's never been a game, I think maybe with the exception of Sonic Racing Transformed, which really captures Sega fandom. And it's just sort of, it's when Sega fandom's at its best, when it's not just about putting pictures about Sonic and Knuckles doing unthinkable things on the internet. Sega fans are sort of very tongue-in-cheek. They're very sort of aware of their own failings. And this game is literally, it captures it absolutely perfectly. The audio is fantastic. The visuals are, you know, they're not pushing the console, but they're really good visuals as well. And just the entire game is just, it's just fun.
Yeah, it's, I think you said it, you know, you said it right at the beginning when you said, you know, like it was like Sega's almost like its back's against the wall. I forget who said it, but they were saying like this was like the crowning, not the crowning glory, but the sort of the tip, essentially, of that creativity. Yeah. And coming out as it did, I mean, it's one of the last games before the cord is literally pulled. It's just so self-deprecating and so knowledgeable, like... So I've never known, I can't think of another game personally myself, specifically on another, you know, non-Sega platform that's so like sharp and on it, like really cutting at times, and unique. Again, like we're talking about unique experiences. Like, yes, obviously, you know, turn-based combat. Yes, you can find it anywhere. Yes, you can find sort of management games. But how it sort of combines these with the mini games Mike talked about and the unique aesthetic and all the jokes and the self-deprecation and the sort of the almost insider jokes about the video game industry as well. Like, yeah, and Sega fandom and just all rolled together. It's a completely unique proposition. And, yeah, it's amazing. My only regret, and this is something that I'm sure Mike doesn't have, I said this years ago on one of the Dreamcast podcasts, is that I never got my hands on the special edition Sega Gaga box set, which now, I mean, the last time I looked was years ago, but it was ludicrously expensive then. So God knows what it's like now.
It's not actually bad. The prices I think it was actually.
Excuse me a minute.
I think it was me and you spoke actually a few years ago about it on a podcast, but we said about, well, possibly in person actually, but we spoke about the fact that I had three special editions I wanted since the start of my Dreamcast collecting, which was the DR Jetson Radio, the Space Channel 5 Part 2, and Sega Gaga. And I picked up Sega Gaga one a couple of years ago. You can get it. I think mine cost 105, which obviously is a lot of money. It's a lot of money. But I spend more than that on absolute tosh. This game's a fantastic game with a fantastic T-shirt which fits me, amazingly enough, and some badges which are just amazingly cool. So it is a game which is just about affordable in terms of limited edition if you want to splurge and have a nice Sega memory. But there are cheaper versions of the game available as well.
How much is the regular, just a normal edition? Is that about 50-ish?
It depends what you call a regular edition. So there's a jewel case version and there's a DVD case version. I think the DVD case version was the one released on the Sega Direct store and the jewel case was the one released in stores. I might be wrong. It sort of changes quite a lot. I would say probably anywhere between £50 and £100.
Okay.
But I think, you know, it's a game which I don't recommend that kind of price for games often. If you can get it for £50-60, it's definitely worth picking up.
Yeah, I agree.
Lewis, have you played this game at all?
I have, unfortunately not, but it is right up my street. Like has been said, the sort of self-deprecating Sega humour in it is like right up my alley. I think anyone who's a Sega fan just wishes they could play through this and... Obviously, it's one of those ones we've always wanted to see patched, you know, into English, but fingers crossed.
I just feel it's like, again, this is my mind. I know there's obviously loads of games that come out afterwards, but for me, it's like, you know, it's like the final, one of the absolute final Dreamcast games, or just because of the content that it has and how it approaches it. I see it in my mind as like the final game. It's like sort of like saluting as Dreamcast sails off into the distance.
Mm-hmm. So... Do you know what? We've got some... So we had some Twitter suggestions, and we will go through them briefly, but I'm conscious that, you know, we are going on to the longer side of a podcast, so we don't want to take too much more of your time. Maybe, and I don't know if this is something that you guys would be up for, maybe we do a part two of this at some point, because I think there's a lot more games that we could talk about, to be honest.
Absolutely,
yeah, totally.
Awesome. Okay, well, what we'll do, before we briefly go through the Twitter suggestions, which I'm sure Michael will give us a very brief explanation of, if you guys could pick one of the games that we've just spoken about to come out today, to be re-released and in English, if needs be, on a modern console, only one of them, which one would you pick, Lewis?
Sega Gaga.
Sega Gaga.
And I think that might be quite a few of you's picks.
Yeah. Mike, what about you?
As much as I love Lack of Love, it has to be Sega Gaga.
Rob?
And it's Sega Gaga.
There we go, me too. So all full house for Sega Gaga. As much as I would want El Dorado Gate, Sega Gaga is definitely up there. So there we go. Sega Gaga is the pick of today. So if you haven't played it, it sounds like you really should go out and pick it up. All right, let's go on to the Twitter suggestions. The first one being the Sakura Wars series, specifically 3. Mm-hmm. Mike, what's so good about these games?
I think Lewis is probably the better person to talk to about Sakura Wars. We spoke about it in quite detail in our... visual novel episode 73 for the Dream Pod.
Yes.
But Lewis is a bigger fan of Sakura Wars than I am, so I shall let him take this one.
Yeah, it's basically a tactical RPG mixed with kind of a dating relationship simulator. It's very popular it was very popular in Japan, as we alluded to on episode 73. We do explain a little bit more about why it's so good on there. But just to say, you know, if you like something like Fire Emblem or Persona, anything like this, which really focuses on the relationships between the characters in like a squad, fellow fighters, then you're gonna love Sakura Wars. Unfortunately, it's one of those ones that has eluded us for many, many years. You can play the first one on the Saturn using an English patch, and also there's a really, really good revisiting, I suppose, that's come out this year. It was in April. They released a sort of a reboot of it, which I've been playing, and it's very, very good. So yeah, check out episode 73 if you want to know more. That we definitely go into more detail there.
Awesome. Another one that I think was on episode 73 that was suggested on the Twitter, Boulder Force EXE. What's this one about, Mike?
So yeah, so it's not really a visual novel. I think we discussed this on 73 actually. It's sort of a visual novel time management style game mixed with two big robots or lots of robots fighting against each other in quite cool sort of top-down view combat. It's a weird game. It's a game which everyone sort of, a lot of people speak very, very highly of. I sort of didn't really get it when I played it. I mean I understand, yeah, it was cool, but not really as good as maybe it's made out to be. I know Stephen at Dreamcast Hub is a massive fan of this game and has done many videos over the years. He loves the game, and I know lots of other people do as well. So maybe I'm just missing something a little bit. But to me, it just never really gelled.
Fair enough. All right, cracking through the other ones we've got. We've got Cul Decept, which is a card game. This one looked really interesting to me, but again, the language barrier here. What's this one about?
So Cul Decept Second.
Okay.
So it's Cul Decept 2, but I think it's referred to as Cul Decept Second. It's okay. Based on a Japanese fantasy. It's a fantasy board game, basically, with game cards. So sort of similar to, and I don't really play this kind of game, so I'm going to completely screw this up probably, but it's like similar to sort of Magic the Gathering type mechanics, I think, okay. But mixed with a board game more. So one of those sort of board game type games rather than a card-based game. Lots of strategy. It's pretty playable if you persevere, I think. PC Wizard has played this game quite recently, I think, and enjoyed it. But yeah, it's. I think you have to have knowledge of the game itself, possibly.
Right.
And again, I might be mixing it up with Magic the Gathering in my head again now, which just, you know, I'm not really into sort of card and board games. So I apologise to anybody. Please don't write any letters of complaint.
Clearly just not geeky enough, Mike.
No, apparently not.
Next one. I want to pronounce it Frame Grid, but I think I heard somebody pronounce it Frame Grid. How do you pronounce this?
Is frame,
it
just frame Grid?
Frame Grid.
Yeah.
Sounds like an odd pronunciation. Grid. Yeah. So this is robots, right? So this is mechs.
Robots.
Got all the robots.
That's it. That's the description you're gonna get. Robots. Is it? Move on to the next game.
robots. Is it?
Yeah.
Very well.
Yeah. So it's From Software. So it's From Software game. Obviously From Software, known more for their Dark Souls and Demon Souls and God knows whatever those games are called now. Also known for Armored Core. So it's that sort of big mech game set in medieval fantasy sci-fi, which obviously makes no sense to anybody, but it's quite cool to look at. It's completely playable without any knowledge of language at all. So I think there is an English translation, which does some of the menus does change, and there's a couple of stats maybe with Japanese language, but it's actually pretty playable without it. It's all right. It's not my sort of game, but it's all right.
I presume this one's probably, I can imagine, has become more popular in recent years, what with Demon Souls and Dark Souls being like so big, you know, and people, a lot of the old From Software games, I think, are getting quite desirable for that reason.
Yeah,
I think so. It's still quite cheap, last time I checked. The English translated version is obviously the way to go if you want to have a fully immersive experience. It's all right. I mean, if you like sort of, I suppose if you like Virtuon stuff, I suppose it's like that. Again, not really my sort of game, but I enjoyed it.
This one's one. It's 1v1, isn't it? In little arenas rather than...
I think so, yeah. It's definitely one-on-one for the battles I've fought. I'm guessing it's only one-on-one, yeah.
Okay, interesting. Moving on, the last game that we had from Twitter was The Last Golem. And I've not heard of this one. What is this one?
Last Golem is a fantastic game. And again, referencing people who've been on a podcast in the past. Aaron is a big fan of this game, I believe, and has written a write-up on the Dreamcast Junkyard in the past, which, again, I think is one of the highest hits you get if you go on Google and search for it, which is, again, good for the Junkyard. Mm-hmm. It's a puzzle game, but it's odd to call it a puzzle game because it doesn't really describe it as well as it should do. It's a 3D sort of world, as it were. Each stage is a sort of 3D world. Basically, it didn't sell many copies at all. It made by one person, I believe, which sort of had some media attention at the time. And basically, you control a rock golem who must guide a somewhat befuddled king to the exit of each stage by clearing the way. The king will only turn in the next possible direction whenever he hits a wall, and it's your job to move these walls around to make his path easier and to allow all walls to be connected to the red wall on each stage at the end of each level. It doesn't sound particularly fun, but as Aaron's review of the game gave it, it's really quite a cool little game. Weirdly enough, it was a game which you could pick up relatively cheaply for quite a while and then suddenly went through the roof in price. I don't know how much it's worth now, but it's, I think last time I saw one, someone tried to sell one for like £165, so ridiculous. I don't think it's worth that much, but it's a cool little game. There's a little creator level mode as well, about 100 levels in the game itself. Another one of those kind of weird Japanese puzzlers that probably wouldn't have looked out of place on European shelves, but also would have been quite budget titles that no one would have actually remembered.
Do you know, listening to all of the games so far, all the ones we've talked about, I say so far, that's all now. That's all the games. We're not going to go through anymore, don't worry. We've been here long enough. But a lot of these sound like games that would do very well now, and we've said that already. But these, yeah. It's almost like these games, they were ahead of their time for the Western market. So no wonder they didn't come out then, but maybe now's the time for them. I think perhaps just over the intervening years between the Dreamcast and now, perhaps Western tastes have changed enough that these are the kind of games that people kind of want to play now. You know, we see stuff like Tokyo Bus Guide nowadays that sells incredibly well, and we see games maybe a bit like Dysperia that appeal to Western audiences. So maybe these are games, if they were to be released on more modern consoles, if we got them ported to Switch, if they were ported to Steam, maybe now they would do well, but perhaps back in the day, they just weren't the kind of games that would do well in the West, I guess.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah. All right, so we don't go on any longer. Let's just go around and let everybody know where they can find you if they would like to. Rob, where can people find you online?
Okay, people can find me on Twitter, and my handle is at rnicholasj, so that's R-N-I-C-H-O-L-A-S-J, rnicholasj on Twitter. And you can also find me at t3.com.
Excellent. Lewis, where can we find you?
You can find me at LewisJFC, Lewis spelled L-E-W-I-S. Check me out.
Check you out indeed. And Mike, where can we find you?
Yep, so to anyone who's actually listened to this entire podcast has made it this far, I am at space_turnip on Twitter. I'm also on Dreamcast Picks. Again, I will clarify, Dreamcast Picks, P-I-C-S, on Twitter, where I post lots of pictures of my collection to absolutely nobody liking them, because it's what I do.
You get a few likes.
I don't even look, to be honest with
you. Just post and leave.
That's what I do, mate.
You can find me at Oddment84 on Twitter. You can also find me at Dreamcast Years, if you fancy it. And, of course, you can find all of us pretty much at the DC Junkyard if you want to see what the Dreamcast Junkyard is up to on Twitter. You can also go to the website, which is thedreamcastjunkyard.co.uk, where lots of articles by Mike Lewis and Rob can be found to read about all these kind of things, and lots of other people, of course, who've written over the years for the Dreamcast Junkyard, and Tom mostly, who can find an article at a moment's notice for any subject. So if you're ever curious, if you've got a question, Tom should be able to find it. We may do a quiz one day where we ask Tom to find an article for anything we decide to bring up.
And
of course, you can find us many other places as well. We're on YouTube. We've got a Facebook group. So come and have a look. Come and interact with us a little bit. And we'll be back again very soon for another episode of Dream Pods. So until then, take care. Bye-bye.
Please stop this disc now.